Good evening, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices.
Oh, I'm on my way back to the country, the place where my heart has always been, to laugh and run and play, free as a child, living life the way it's meant to be. Oh, I'm on my way back to the country, the place where my heart has always been. I thought I'd have to wait till my life's end to go to the country. Yes, the country, that's my home. Oh, I've been away too long from the country. I left over 30 years ago to live in city life and raise my children there. It wasn't quite the same for them as me. Oh, they missed the peace and quiet of the country, where life moves slowly through the days, and there is time to see the eyes of God in the country. Yes, the country, that's my home. Oh, we all belong to the country that's been home for each and every one. Where natives walk this earth in silent skin-clad feet, and bow to tall trees waving in the wind. Oh, we all belong to the country. That quiet place is somewhere in our hearts. And may we come to find that peace of mind in the country. Yes, the country, that's our home. Oh, I'm on my way back to the country, the place where my heart has always been.
My guest this evening, Barbara Alice Mann, an Ohio Bear Clan Seneca and a PhD scholar, is a faculty member at the University of Toledo. She has authored 9 books, the latest of which is The Tainted Gift, on the deliberate spread of disease to natives by settlers as a land-clearing tactic. Her internationally famous Iroquoian Women, The Gontoesis, is in its 3rd printing with a foreword by Paula Gunn Allen. Allen writes, "Man demonstrates effectively that once there was a world in which women possessed the dignity and stature naturally theirs by virtue of their sex. Their station did not come to them from men. They were not granted status. Indeed, they were the grantor of any status that was to be had. Not only did the matrons of man's Iroquoian people control the fields and their produce, but they were also in charge of the distribution of all food and other consumables. They were the source of most information, except that pertaining only and exclusively to males, political power, custom, and tradition." Barbara Mann writes, "I can only trust that my message, the extraordinarily high political, economic, social, and religious status of Iroquoian women, will ring a bell with feminists, I have been troubled in the past to note that the facts of Iroquoian sisterhood, once so dear to Seneca Fall feminists as to have formed their beacon of hope, are almost wholly unknown to their modern counterparts. Three other internationally known books, George Washington's War on Native America, Daughters of Mother Earth, out in paperback as Make a Beautiful Way, and Native Americans, Archaeologists, and the Mounds are multiply reprinted. In addition, Dr. Mann is a nationally honored scholar of James Fenimore Cooper and has recently published various articles on the little-known connection between Cooper and Jane Austen. Sounds interesting. She is also the author of dozens of chapters and articles. Barbara is a friend and colleague of Ward Churchill and recently testified on his behalf at his trial, which he just won, as an expert witness on the deliberate spread of disease by settlers. Welcome, Barbara.
Hello, how are you?
Hello there. Hi. Welcome to Women's Voices. I'm delighted you are able to be here with us and so appreciate your staying up late to do this interview.
So this late here.
Well, it is. My first question to guests, considering that this is Women's Voices, mm-hmm. is how have the generations of women before you, your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother, influenced you to become the woman that you are today?
Well, in Native culture, the seven generations is a really important thought. I know that an awful lot of non-Native people have heard of this, things going to the seventh generation and being aware of the seventh generation. We actually take it in a very personal way because we tend to know our own immediate families going back as many generations as we can, and then, of course, trying to look forward as many as we can. So the very first of the women that I have my direct ancestress that I know about was leaving from the Greenville Treaty 1795 because she flatly just disagreed with the idea of making peace, however coerced, with George Washington and the new United States, and realized that the result was going to be the forced seizure of the state of Ohio. So she went up to Detroit to resist that takeover and to throw in with a counter-council that was happening up there at the time, just to say, no, I'm not going to be part of this, of giving away the homeland. And she stayed up there and actually went up into Ontario because, you know, they seized Michigan pretty soon, too. Ontario was Canadian. It was like nowhere you could go to get away from it. But yeah. Ontario was also Iroquoian land. So, you know, she's the very first one that I know on personal details about. And then it was her daughter, actually her granddaughter, who escaped from the nuns because in the generations that followed, you know, the settlers would just seize the children and throw them in the boarding schools. And so my great-great-grandmother was the young woman at that time who'd basically been thrown into one of these kid prisons and been raised that way. But the nuns named her La Barbara because she flatly refused to get with the program. It means the barbarian, basically, in French. The nuns spoke French. And I know that when she was 16 years old, she escaped from the nuns, and she told that story, and the word she used was escaped from the nuns. She stole a canoe and paddled around Lake Erie down the Maumee, which is the Great Miami of the lake, because she knew there were holdouts there. And so she escaped from the settlers and the boarding school.
Yeah.
And that's always been an important story to me of a great independence. She was 16 years old when she did this.
It's amazing.
Yes, and then she had children, and her daughter was Waree, who was my great-grandmother. And she was also quite a pistol, not willing to go along with the loss of land and culture, and she maintained her own ways, including the old farming ways. And actually, I lived with her. She raised me the first few years of my life, so I have personal knowledge of her. And, you know, it's always kind of been amazing to me that she was born in 1845, And I knew somebody born in 1845, and she was a very old woman when she was. I was with her, but for the last few years of her life, I actually knew her, so I always felt like I was carrying forward from her direct line from the great-great-great-grandmother who left and refused to be part of giving away Ohio. So that's always been pretty important to me. She knew all the best stories and all the funny stories, and we spoke different languages, but none of them was English. So when she died, I was thrown into an English-only atmosphere. It was very strange. My grandmother actually died before I was born, so all I have of her are stories and some baskets and such things that she made that the family kept, mainly because she considered them not good enough to sell. And so just coming forward from there, you know, she lost her children, is the way it was always said. They were seized and sent to boarding school. Mm-hmm. So that's the experience that I come out of, and I, you know all those stories and a lot more than I've just mentioned here. And they all do form you, and they all make you look forward into what kind of a story am I going to be in the fifth, sixth generation from where I am now, you know. Yeah. Who's going to remember me? How long will my granddaughter live? Will she say, oh, gee, I knew somebody who was born in 1947?
Right. Right. Among your stories, I think it's so important, really, for us to know is the treatment that one of your ancestors received as a child because she was left-handed.
Oh, yeah, we're a bunch of lefties in my family. Yes, that was my grandmother. She was in one of these schools. Yeah, I don't know if your listeners know about the Indian boarding schools.
I'm sure they do.
They were basically kid prisons, and you were sent there for the high crime of being born Indian.
Right.
And she was left-handed, and this was very offensive to the nuns who had her, because apparently that meant that you were the direct servant of the devil or something like that. So they were trying to force her to be right-handed. She was all 4 years old. And four-year-old children do not understand why they shouldn't be left-handed. So two of the nuns held her down while the third nun systematically broke every knuckle in her left hand, crippling her hand for life.
Wow.
And every time I think of that, especially when I look at my little granddaughter, and I think, my God, how could anybody do that to a little kid like that? But for the rest of her life, she was forcibly right-handed. I don't know that that saved her in any material way, but
probably not.
That's what happened.
Wow! How outrageous, really.
It was criminal, is what it was.
Well, yes, of course it was. What propelled you into teaching and writing? You were obviously a gifted student. You graduated summa cum laude and mm-hmm. was the undergraduate class of valedictorian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all kinds of those kinds of honors. Actually,
yes.
I went into academia because I was too damn sick to do anything else for a living. I was later in life. I was in my late 40s when I went back to academia because my lungs and kidneys have never been very good, and they were just giving out on me completely. And I was really too sick to have a 9-to-5 real job. So, well, you know, I was trying to figure out what I could do for a living, and my husband said, well, you know, you were always good at academia, and, you know, so why don't you just go back and do something there? So I went in, and basically I was just going back for my master's, because I thought maybe I could teach, and that wouldn't be a hard job, physically hard, not physically demanding. And then I found out that if you're going to teach, you really need the PhD, so I just continued through. So basically it was because I needed a job.
Well, that's amazing. So you were in your 40s before you...
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Oh, yes. And I think it was very important that I was older when I went back. And, you know, I was sitting in a class with 25-year-old kids.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is my personality was already there. My opinions, my reasoning skills were already there, and, you know, it's pretty hard to run a line of a bull past a woman in her late 40s.
I know.
She's going to resist it.
I know. I was in school when I was 50. So.
Yes, and well, then you know what I'm talking
I
about.
I do.
You can see how easily they run roughshod over these 20-year-old kids that really either can't stand up for themselves or don't know they ought to be standing up for themselves.
Yeah.
And I remember being quite angry at the way I was seeing Native America being presented in these books that I had to read. And I had to read all of them for the different kinds of tests, you know, the master's and PhD tests. And all of them were saying just the most grossly incorrect and sometimes just flatly obscene things about Native Americans. I decided I needed to do something about that. And also, you know, I'd been told by the elders, and at that point I wasn't one of the elders, telling me, well, you know, you got this opportunity, you're sitting there, you have to do this. So there were a lot of reasons that I wound up doing it.
Well, I'm going to interrupt and say this is Janie Reasoner, and you are listening to Women's Voices, and my guest is Barbara Alice Mann, an Ohio Bear Clan Seneca, and a PhD scholar at faculty member at the University of Toledo, and she's written many books, and we're going to be talking especially about Iroquoian women, the Gantowesis. You were a friend of Paula Gunn Allen.
Yes, indeed.
And you two were planning a book together when she died.
Yeah, actually, we had been, we started planning it before she knew that she had cancer. The book was to be on Native American spirituality. I wanted to do something about the real spiritual systems east of the Mississippi River, and I knew that I wasn't as attuned to the cultures west because they're very different. And I was talking to Paula about this, and she said, yes, there are things, really important things I want to do here before it's too late. And she wanted to do a book on spirituality in the west, so I said, well, we should put our efforts together, and I can do east, you can do west. And we were planning it along those lines. She was shopping it around to her publisher. She wanted to try the big trade publisher first. I'm in academia, which is a different publishing system entirely. And then she became so ill, you know, and so it basically I wasn't going to go ahead and do anything without her, and I thought it would be cruel to go ahead after she found out she was very sick.
Yeah.
So I didn't.
Yeah, but you do plan to do that at some time.
I do want to, and I will certainly dedicate it to Paul.
Yes.
But I will only do the East. I think it would be presumptuous for me to talk about Western people.
Mm-hmm. You'll also be the keynote speaker in an International Matriarchal Studies Conference in Toledo this fall.
Toronto.
Right.
Toledo's a little too small. I don't think International will be here. Yes, Toronto, which is actually not too far. It's about a 4.5-hour drive from here.
Well, that's handy.
Yeah, so I'll be running up there and staying as long as I can. They always schedule these things right in the middle of the semester. You know, it's hard to get away when you're teaching.
I bet it is.
It is, and it's very exhausting because you've got to run there, do the keynote, do whatever you're doing, then run back, try to get your mind back into whatever the class was doing before it meets. It's difficult.
Right.
Wearing.
Our Constitution was greatly influenced by the Iroquois.
Yes.
You write, the colonials were heavily influenced by the Great League of Peace,
mm-hmm.
and a kind of democracy that implied equality took root. You write, the shot heard round the world was fired from an Iroquois gun. I like that.
A little hyperbole on my part, but...
Well, it's true, really. I mean, that's...
It's a metaphor, yes.
Yeah, because that kind of democracy certainly wasn't known or lived in Europe.
Not at all, although there are a lot of people who are still trying to pretend that everything that the Iroquois knew about democracy they learned from the settlers. Simply not true. If you look at the European antecedents, what you've got is ancient Greece, which, of course, was a slave-holding patriarchal culture where only the upper classes got to be involved in any of this so-called democracy. Mm-hmm. Or else you get something like the Magna Carta, which happened 68 years after the Iroquois League was formed. And then again, what have you got? You've got a bunch of warlords basically agreeing that they're not going to impinge on each other's holdings. You know, so mm-hmm. where's all this democracy they're talking about?
Right.
Nothing like what the Iroquois had and have. By the way, the League still exists. In fact, it exists doubly up in Canada and also here in the States.
Really?
Yes. Yes, after the Revolutionary War, Zandon Nagao, who was called Joseph Brant in English, who had fought, they always say on the British side instead of on the Iroquois side, but against the rebels, the colonists. He went up into Canada and set up a second league because it looked like the league in New York was going to be totally crushed. And to be sure, the Revolutionary Army did its very best to wipe out all the Iroquois.
Yeah.
Didn't succeed, but they sure tried.
I'm going to skip around here a little bit. I'm actually looking at page 214, Haudenosaunee Constitution. The economic rules of the League were written into the Great Law, and women shall be considered the progenitors of the nation, it states. They shall own the land and the soil. The word own here is misleading to Euro-Americans. Private property rights are not implied. Women are the stewards, the keepers of Mother Earth, not her grasping overlords. What they hold is a sacred trust, not an exploitative right.
Yes. Yes.
And the bond between Gantoesis and Mother Earth was part of the deeply spiritual bond, of course I'm reading out of your book, among all women, forged largely through their ability to bring life into being. Just as women created new life in their own wombs, they had the sacred right to bring forth new life from the womb of Mother Earth, i.e., to farm.
Yes. Women are the farmers, and throughout the eastern woodlands, and I believe that holds true a lot west of the Mississippi as well, the women alone are the farmers. The men had no part in farming. They were involved in forest conservation. They did not just, they're always presented in European tracts as hiding behind trees and running around and opportunistically hunting animals. That's not what they were doing. They were tending the forest. It was a preserve where there were, if they knew, for example, that deer particularly liked a kind of plant, they would put it in the right kind of spaces for deer who would then come. And they would make sure that nothing was being overpopulated, nothing was underpopulated. They didn't go around murdering all the wolves, for example,
right,
because the wolves were an important part of keeping the deer population in check. They also didn't go out and just massacre everything that moved in the woods.
Right.
There were very specific animals that were marked for dinner, and they were judiciously taken, and they were only taken after a great deal of prayer, and they asked forgiveness of the spirit of the animal every time it was taken. There were some women who were vegetarian. That was a personal choice. Some women lived entirely on the vegetable sustenance that they raised, and that was a matter of choice. It was not required, but it was certainly a choice if you wanted to make it. And some men would live entirely on jerky and not bother the women's field. So it was a lot of choice in your diet, but animals were definitely not hunted to extinction and definitely not treated as lesser creatures than human beings. And by the way, when the men came back from anything like the hunt or if there was a war, and we only had wars of European styles after Europeans came, before they came back into town, before they were allowed back in town, there was a lot of decompression time that they had to spend in the sweat lodge. And what they had to do was rid themselves of all those violent things they'd been doing and get that stench of death off them, because they were death bringers. And you were just not going to allow them around women and children when they had that kind of spirit on them. So this is why they had to spend so much time in sweat lodges to purify. And it bothers me very much today when I see people saying, oh, why didn't they let the women in the sweat lodge? Oh, that was discrimination against women. Oh, by gosh, we're going to hold a mixed sweat, and by gosh, women are going to sweat as much as men. Oh, women have to sweat on their moons. What a bunch of hooey. Women don't have to sweat because women are born pure. Men have to sweat because they do these violent things. Now, a woman, if she went to war, yes, she had to sweat because she'd been made man for that duration. But by and large, women do not need to sweat unless they're sick or there's a particular spiritual issue they need to deal with. And by the way, having your period does not count as being sick.
Right.
Counts as being privileged.
Right, exactly. Well, it's too bad that the young men coming back from Iraq don't have a similar
experience. I think it's very important, and Native men coming back will go in the sweat.
Uh-huh.
They will. By the way, mixed sweats, for anybody that might not know it, are very bad ideas. That's men and women sweating together. Very bad ideas. You're confusing the medicines.
Uh-huh.
Very, very bad idea.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I've been in sweats and think they're wonderful, but that's interesting to hear that. Moving on to page 224, women's agriculture formed the backbone of the Iroquoian economy, and they produced 65% of the people's food. And I'm going to read some of these crops that they produced in that area are just amazing. The amount of crops necessary to sustain this sizable Iroquoian populace was enormous, and the size of the women's fields should not be underestimated. Among the Wyandots of Canada, town fields averaged at least 60 acres of 25,000 planting mounds per acre. Further south, where the weather was fairer and the growing season longer, each Haudenosaunee town typically kept several hundred acres under cultivation. These extensive fields supported huge populations. In 1613, Champlain counted 20,000 inhabitants in 18 Wyandot towns. For his part, Le Jeunet, I'm sure I'm massacring these names, recorded a population of 30,000 Wyandots in his immediate vicinity in 1633, while in 1632, Gabriel Sagard counted between 200 and 300 households living in 30 to 40 longhouses in the town of, I couldn't begin to pronounce the name. Each household contained dozens of members. Thus, the large scale of cultivations not only supported populations of at least 2,000 inhabitants per town, but resulted in extraordinary yields that staggered the European imagination. I've tried to read the amount of grain per acre, and I'm thinking that in France, tell me if I'm wrong, it was at one bushel per acre in off years and six bushel in the best years. And then in the Iroquois land, it was 27 bushels per acre.
So yeah, the yields were much, much higher in Native America. And part of that is because we didn't totally deplete the soil, and also because we used fertilizer, which is a Native American invention, and also because the women studied the land and understood exactly how many seeds to plant per pocket, exactly how far apart to space the seeds, exactly how much light each plant needed, exactly who wanted to grow in the shade, who needed a post to climb up. So they didn't just broadcast, just scatter seeds over some newly dug up land. There was very careful planning, and it was mathematical, geometrical planning that went into all of the planting to make the most of the seeds you had, give each seed the best chance of germinating. And also, by the way, you would germinate it in medicine water, like the same way people will start plants in their basement before they go and put them out in the spring.
Really?
At least hereabouts. I don't know how that works in California there, but
yeah,
hereabouts,
sure.
We have very different seasons and temperatures.
Right.
So you would germinate plants in medicine water, which was a kind of a fertilizer bath, like Miracle Grow.
Mm-hmm.
Before you would plant them, so they had the
right.
best possible start.
Yeah. Oh, no,
so it
they
was very different planting from what the Europeans did.
Had done. Yeah, no, they do. People do starts here as well. Mm-hmm. It said in 1553, this Jacques Cartier also witnessed plowed fields and fair, large meadows full of their manner of corn swaying in the wind around the well-cultivated and most fertile island in the St. Lawrence River. A month earlier, he had seen so many vines loaded with grapes that it seemed they could have only been planted by husbandmen. You write, in fact, they were tended by husband women.
Yes, they were.
The extraordinary productivity of women continued up through the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
George Washington aimed to destroy the league allied to the British by destroying the women's fields. This is so heartbreaking to read. Yeah. In 1779, he ordered General John Sullivan to seize that year's Seneca harvest, but not even Washington was prepared for the reports coming back to him enumerating her losses. Major Burroughs recorded that Sullivan sweep netted 100 acres of beans, cucumbers, Simblons, I don't know what that is.
It's a kind of melon.
Is it? Watermelon, muskmelon, and pumpkins. 150 acres of corn, 18 feet high, with cobs a foot and a half long.
Mm-hmm.
60,000 bushels of corn, 2,000 to 3,000 bushels of beans, 200 acres of corn. Meanwhile, Sullivan reported to Washington that his Colonel Butler had destroyed in Cayuga a fruit orchard of 1,500 bearing trees and 160 bushels of corn, not counting other vegetables.
And that was just reports from two of the officers. There were hundreds of officers doing the same thing.
Yes, it's tough.
And in George Washington's War, I spend a whole chapter enumerating everything that was destroyed.
Oh.
60 towns, the entire peach and apple orchard, all the corn, all of the other plants, deliberately decimated, destroyed. Mm-hmm. And what they couldn't eat themselves, they burned or they threw in the river or they somehow destroyed.
Yeah. Oh, it's just, again, obscene. Broadhill reported back to Washington on his complete destruction of the Muskeebum breadbasket, estimating his plunder proceeds at $30,000, an astounding figure in 1781. He also noted that burning the towns and the fields had taken him 3 days, noting rather wistfully that I never saw finer corn.
Mm. Yes, and these reports come over and over and over again, and they continue that all the way up through, you know, the seizure of Ohio, that continues.
Yeah.
The revolution broke back of the league in New York, but it was not broken in Pennsylvania or Ohio yet. It took another 25 years of warfare before they could break the western part in western Pennsylvania and Ohio.
I'm going to interrupt and say it's 7:33, and you're listening to KZYX. I'm Janie Reasoner. I'm here with my guest, Barbara Alice Mann, and we're talking about the Iroquois. In the midst of such, I'm reading again from 227, in the midst of such abundance and the absence of European militia, harvest was a festive time. Women alone did the harvesting until the assimilationists' pressures of the 19th century were brought to bear. And this just sounds wonderful. Clans plucked and worked bees just as they had planted 3 months before. Sometimes the corn was pulled from the stalks and carried back to town, the fields later burned over. However, often the whole corn stalks were pulled from the ground and carried back to town where, by moonlight, they were husked clean within easy reach of refreshments, as elder men amused the work crews by going gaga, as the Iroquois say, i.e. spinning light-hearted tales to pass the time. For the storytelling season began with the harvest. Surplus crops were dried for storage, with corn ears braided together in bundles that were strung up along the rafters of the longhouse. Fall was the time of one of the greatest festivals in the seasonal round of Iroquoian ceremonies. Green corn time started in late August and ran into October, and no one went home hungry.
Yep, that's about right.
Wow. A lot different than today's world.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, I think farmers do it very similarly. If you go out in smaller farm communities, you get something that same everybody in it together kind of a spirit. It's certainly lacking in the cities.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I know that's what happens where I grew up on the farm in Illinois. I mean, that's what happens now. And harvesting, of course, now you're carrying the grain in a truck off to the mill, you know.
Yeah,
or
well, you got trucks now. Yeah,
right.
Changes it a bit.
But
still, it's that
the
same
community
spirit
helps.
Of everybody pulling together. And I've seen that in European farm communities, too. And it's nice whoever's doing it.
It is. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good thing for children to grow up seeing that kind of communal, everybody in it effort. Children don't see enough of that communal, we're in it thing together.
Absolutely not. I mean, I don't even think children do housework anymore.
Well, I think it depends on the children. I know my granddaughter does.
Well, so many mothers are working even, yeah. You know, so that kind of everybody pitching in together to get things done is a rare thing. Good that happens in your family.
I think it's very alienating and unfortunate that children are not shown that, because children really need to know that they belong somewhere. And if they grow up feeling like appendages, expensive appendages at that, I think it really damages their self-esteem.
Yeah, I think you're right. Another aspect of
matriarchal?
Yeah, matriarchal life was gifting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so not understood. Could you talk about that?
The gift economy.
Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely not the exchange economy, which most people think is the only economy. You know, and I've actually heard people, oh, well, once communism was defeated, there's only capitalism that's shown to be the greatest system in the world. Yeah, greatest system that's tanked right now. But the gifting system is not like that. In the first place, it's not based on an assumption of scarcity. It's based on an assumption of plenty. It's also based on the assumption that the first act is the gift. That's always the first act is the gift. The gift is properly responded to with another gift, and it's not any of this proportional stuff. You're not exchanging things of equal value. It's proportional to what you happen to have. So you give what you happen to have, and hopefully the best of what you have, and other people give them the best of what they have, and pretty much it circulates, and everybody gets what they need is the basic theory of it. And it worked actually very well before the Europeans arrived, and it's even still working to this day. The notion that it's frail and it collapses the minute it comes face to face with European capitalist exchange economy, it's just not true. It certainly exists. If it wasn't for the gift economy, I don't think capitalism would have lasted as long as it has.
It's the gift economy, of course, is unseen, right?
It's unseen in European terms. It was definitely seen and understood in native terms.
Right.
Everybody knew what was going on.
Right.
Europeans didn't know what they were looking at. They thought it was primitive barter, and that's what they keep saying in all their chronicles. Not what it was. It was very fine-tuned. It was very much based on who had what, who needed what, and part of the ethos is the more important a person is, the more honorable and the more that person is to be listened to, the less that person has, because he or she is always giving it away.
Right. You write that by cultural contrast, gifting was not personally instigated. It was instead a systemic obligation of communal living. Because gifting was a value, the highest Iroquoian officers were not the wealthiest people, but often the poorest.
Yes, and that only increased the esteem that the people had for them, because the only way they got poor was by giving away everything. And part of the result was that everybody would come by and give them things. These elders who had given away everything could be assured that everybody that walked by would be giving them something they were never going to be in need. And usually the minute you were out the door, they're turning around giving half of it away to somebody else. Mm. But that still goes on to this day. To this day when you see important elders are doing that.
You're talking about in the Indian culture?
Yes.
That it's going on?
Yes.
Hmm. You've written here too, what comes from one must go to the other and back again in the never-ending circle of the cosmic dance of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, what women kept in the gendered world of agricultural cycled back around to the men during the seasonal round of festivals.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, what came from one clan soon returned to it again. What came from one nation revolved back around to the donor nation. As with farming, gifting was equated with breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And Iroquois complimented Captain John Norton's grasp of gifting principles in the late 18th century this way. He has strong milk and big breasts, which yield plentifully.
Yeah. And men were proud to have been described that way.
Yeah.
When a man was described that way, he was very proud of it. Native American men were not at all ashamed to be compared favorably to women or described in terms that modern Western culture would think is really sexist, female sexist. They were pleased and honored to have been described in that way, because it meant that they were the best givers, that they nourished and kept people alive.
Yes. You write, a greed may appear inborn to a materialistic culture, but it's created scarcities with its carefully crafted inequities, but only because bully boy economics are allowed to ride roughshod over all else. It's not incidental that the roots of European economics stretch back to a warlord system of plunder run by heavily armed young men whose levels of testosterone vastly exceeded their levels of maturity. I think this is interesting. In the final analysis, capitalism is nothing more than a sophisticated expression of a prepubescent boy's explanation of the universe. Mine's bigger. I get yours.
Yeah, and basically I've seen nothing since I wrote that that would make me reconsider. I think it's only more true when I stop and think about how much capitalism is really just an expression of the raiding culture of Europe. That's all it is.
Yes, it is. That's very true. We open up the phone lines about this time. If anybody would like to call in, the telephone number is 937-5973. I'll say that again. 937-5973. To go on with this, you write, an interesting alternative to this orientation surfaced in the Iroquoian system, which worked to keep the immature ruffians at bay. Among the Iroquois, half-grown men were subject to their grandparents, male and female, elders who had the wisdom and experience to lift their eyes beyond self-aggrandizement to the welfare of the whole community. Women, grandmother was high on the list of public officials to whom youth were required to defer.
And that's still true to this day.
It is. They
in traditional culture is the grandmothers and grandfathers, but certainly in the matriarchal cultures of the East, it's the grandmothers. Grandmothers. And the grandfathers are happy to defer as well. It's not one of those snarling battle of the sexes things that the Europeans set up. It's not even conceived of as battle. It's conceived of as interdependent kind of a reciprocity. The male-female thing is not seen in warlike terms. We don't hate men, and men don't hate women. It's just not the way it works.
Uh-huh.
You're grateful for each other's work and whatever they can contribute the best. And young people definitely do not rule the roost. Young people are respectful and defer to their elders. And, of course, that means that the elders have an absolute responsibility to be responsible. That really puts a lot more on the elders' shoulders to actually be worthy of all that deference.
So where is that happening now that Indian children are, young boys
anywhere
are
anywhere you see anything like a traditional group, and that's any kind of a community that's a native community, a native descended community. And I think actually reservations are some of the worst examples, because they're really just concentration camps run by the settlers. And it's been very, very recently that hasn't been true, and still the tribal councils are not set up in the traditional way. They're actually under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1933, I think it was. Basically, they ended the old chiefs and grandmothers, the grandfathers and grandmothers councils, to put in these supposedly elected ones. But really, they were just they were puppets of the federal government that would be willing to sign all these terrible leasing agreements that allow uranium mining with no safety controls, and taking royalties that are grossly, grossly below what the corporations would have to pay if they were on so-called American soil. So it was just a ploy for creating internal colonies, and that's all that the reservations are. So in a lot of instances, some of the most Euroform behavior you're going to see among natives is going to happen in and around the reservations, especially the political dynamics of some of them. Now, some have been, in the last 20 years, seizing back control for more traditional ways, but a lot of the very traditional people are not living on reservations. They're living in kind of along the fringes of settler culture.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Where they hid out in the first place, refusing to be scooped up and sent to the sent west to death.
Right.
You know, west is the direction of death.
Uh-huh.
So when you talk about people being sent west, you're being talking about them being sent to death.
Really? Huh. We hear about such domestic violence and alcoholism that's so high on those reservations.
That's the, first of all, that's the reservation thing. Second of all, that's the new, and actually not so new, Indian stereotype. It's a racial stereotype. And there are, I've known plenty of Indians that, you know, were into drugs and alcohol, but I've known plenty that weren't, just as I've known plenty Euro-Americans that are into drink, drugs, and alcohol. But somehow or another, someone gets saddled with the stereotype, gets to be Native America. The majority of the violence perpetrated against Indian women is perpetrated by non-Indian men.
Really?
Yes.
No, there are horrific statistics about women in Canada in some areas, and I've forgotten where.
Yeah, well, because they are a population that nobody's going to defend.
Yeah, you can get away with anything.
Boy, yeah, the bully boy ethos is go beat up on whoever you can get away with beating up on.
Yeah. Huh. Well, quite a scene. Again, if you'd like to call in and speak with our guest, you have a question or comment, the telephone number is 937-5103, area code 707 if you're calling from far away, 707-937-5103. Thomas Jefferson dropped the bombshell that Native infertility was really willful. Right?
Yeah.
That they were doing it themselves. Women having learned the practice of procuring abortion by the use of some vegetable.
Yes.
So, that's how they managed. That was for a number of reasons.
Women, first of all, there's the theoretical thing of whose body is it anyway? And Native women in the East anyway never had the slightest hesitation to say, it's my body. And I'm going to do what I want with it. Also, Native women do not think it's proper to have more children than you can sustain in a reasonable way. And sustaining goes far beyond just feeding one child. You know, it's not just feeding and clothing a child. It's giving that child attention. And the idea of having a second child before the first child is old enough to walk, talk, feed itself, dress itself, and get itself around without hurting itself 4 or 5 years old. We're talking is considered actually pretty irresponsible to have another child. Furthermore, you wanted to be careful that you were not straining anybody's resources or anybody's patience. The woman herself didn't necessarily do all the child care. There'd be other women in the clan house that would help take care, but there would be other children besides the ones she was raising. And you wanted to be careful that you weren't overburdening the help. Also, there was the idea that if something bad was happening, let's say that there was a tornado. I know that California, that sounds strange to you, just like earthquakes sound strange in Ohio. But in Ohio, you get tornadoes. And those are pretty major events. You learn to read the clouds and know when those are coming. And if you have to spend all your time running around counting noses, trying to find that, where's that other kid, where's that other kid? You know, a lot of people are going to get killed because instead of taking the shelter they need to take in the cave, they're going to be running about trying to gather up all these little kids. So there are a lot of different reasons that you would want to have fewer children spaced out instead of burdening one woman with having all these children.
Well, it makes good sense, of course.
Yeah, of course it does.
That's why their life worked.
Yeah, and we also didn't have the ravaging diseases of Europe. You know, one of the reasons that Europeans were pressed to have so many children, European women, aside from that silly be fruitful and multiply thing, is that so many of the children would die before they reached adulthood. Mm-hmm. We didn't have rampant diseases. We didn't live in hovels, and we didn't live in miserable circumstances with every dirty animal, never taking baths. We were very clean people, still are, and we didn't live in kind of those hovels that the Europeans used to. We didn't have those epidemic diseases till Europeans brought them over with them. So, you know, if you had a child, you could reasonably expect to see that child grow up, live, marry, have children, and become a grandpa.
How wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So we didn't even have those considerations, the idea that you need an heir and a spare, to use that crude British phrase. That was not even a concept with us, because barring some extraordinary event like a tree falling on a child or a kid accidentally falling off a cliff, that child was going to grow up.
Now, as far as marriage was concerned, you're right, marriage did not imply any duty of fidelity for the Iroquois.
Nope.
So could you expound on that?
Sexuality was free and open and as much or as little as you wanted. Started at puberty and continued, I think I said, till everybody was exhausted. youngsters, I'm talking teenagers, were actually assumed to be doing the right thing if they had as many sex partners as possible, because that way they start learning the difference between lust and real regard for a person. And that is a different thing. And when your hormones are crazy, you're not making really good decisions. So nobody was pressed to make any decisions during that period between about 13 and 19, when all human beings are insane, right? Instead, everybody just got out of the way and dipped with the flow. That's a very important idea, to dip with the flow. Do people look like that's a period in their life when all they're thinking about is sex? Okay, then just get out of their way and let it be. We know how to abort unwanted fetuses, so it wasn't going to be any difficulties. And then that way, when people were a little older, they had a little sanity about them, they could start choosing a mate based on real considerations of, wait a minute, can I really get along with this person for any length of time? Wait a minute, do I really want to have children in common with this person? So it seemed to us that you could have as many mates as you wanted, and even if you were married, so what? You know, if you're married and your husband's gone to a council, he's going to be gone for a year, who said that you had to tie up all your urges and put them on a shelf? Nobody thought that. It was perfectly acceptable for you to have a lover, and he could have a lover if he wanted to, whatever he was. There was none of that fidelity. And, you know, fidelity in Europe is about ensuring that patriarchy knows exactly whose children are inheriting a man's wealth. And it's also about fear on the part of women of losing their economic support.
Mm-hmm.
So these were not even operative, because everybody always knew they had enough to eat. Everybody always knew that when they came home, you could get in, you had a bed to sleep in, and everybody knew that if marriage didn't work out, you still had people who liked you, would talk to you, and it was still going to work out in your life. So we didn't have any of those European-style pressures.
Yes, and the children lived with their mother in the mm-hmm. longhouses.
Yes. Yeah, yes, and that's something that modern jurisprudence has borrowed from Native Americans generally. It was in the European form of divorce, if divorce was ever allowed, the man, of course, kept all the wealth, and he also kept all the children.
Right.
But when the people started seeing the Native American way, it looked like it was making more sense, and it does make more sense. The children, 12 and under, are with their mom. There's no question about it. That's all there is to it. They are with their mother. And by the way, being with your mother meant was being with all the mothers, with her sisters, with her grandmothers, and with all the women who were around. So it wasn't like you were an isolated,
yeah.
Abandoned person as you were in Europe. And then when the children turned 12, they basically could choose which custodial parent they wanted to live with. And sometimes the boys would want to spend time with their dads, in their dad's hunting lodge, as opposed to with their mom's brother in his hunting lodge. And so they were allowed that choice, and girls could also choose, although that was very rare that a girl wouldn't stay with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
She would be giving up her matriarchal rights if she didn't live with her mother.
I was wondering if there was, do you have some kind of contact information if people should want to reach you? Or maybe not. Maybe you'll have to wait until the website.
Well, it's not hard to find me. Just I'm at the University of Toledo. It's not hard to find me.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All we need to do is look in the English department at the University of Toledo.
This is such an important subject, and like we hear about the suffragettes, but we do not hear that they were influenced, heavily influenced, by what they saw in your culture.
Oh, yeah, the Seneca Falls Convention took place at Seneca Falls because they were in 1948, because they were entirely aware of the Iroquois League and that the woman was the mother of all, which was a standing woodlands commonplace. And I have been disturbed by the number of feminists I've met, and I'm talking Western feminists, especially in academia, who seem oblivious of Native American culture and who are operating on downright racist stereotypes of what Native American culture is. You know, the little Indian maiden and the deep, big warrior who runs everything, the chief, and the women can't come around. It's just astounding the kinds of nonsense that are being put forward and believed by people who really ought to know better.
It
dismays me when I see that.
Well, yes, I should say so. It's very important that we know that we have these images of how life might be and run successfully. You know, we are running out of time. I want to thank you so much, Barbara. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and I think we've all learned a lot. Thank you again.
All right,
thank you,
and good night.
Good night.
Our life goes on along its merry way. Looking for the good times, the fun and the play. While inside is an aching that won't go away, and we wonder why in heaven are we here today. We fight with our children, wives and husbands too. More we have to suffer through.